You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row.
James Badenoch, QC, is now retired from the cut and thrust of the courtroom, but he spent 35 years specialising in clinical negligence and medical law. He has appeared in a succession of major cases in the High Court and the Appeal Courts. I've come to see him in his home in Barnes to discuss one of the main issues that he dealt with when acting in these medical negligence cases. Medicine was different from other walks of life for a while, because when there was alleged negligence or omission to advise the patient properly, the test was not for the court to apply. It was for a respectable body of reasonable medical opinion. In other areas of endeavour, it is the court that sets the standards and determines what constitutes reasonable care. James, can you explain how this anomaly crept into clinical negligence cases?
Yes, certainly. It's laid at the door of a case, an English case, called Bolam against Free and Varnett, decided in 1957 when juries tried civil cases. The judge's direction to the jury became, in a very extreme way, enshrined in the English law of negligence as it applies to medical practice. What the judge essentially said was that in the medical profession there's room for many perfectly valid differences of opinion, and that in a given case where negligence by a doctor was alleged, it was not enough for a judge to prefer the evidence of the plaintiff, as we then called them, to the evidence given on behalf of the defendant. If there was at least a respectable body of reasonable medical opinion that would sanction or approve what was done or was not done, there was no room, said the judge to the jury, for them to find negligence. With the consequence, of course, that the standard of care was being set by doctors for doctors, essentially, and not by judges or courts of law imposing it on doctors. Very different, has already been said, from all other walks of life. When that case was followed in a leading case called Maynard against the West Midlands, the same principle was strongly endorsed by the Court of Appeal, including Lord Scarman. And the Times published a law report of the case of Maynard with the heading, "No Negligence Where Doctors Disagree." Now, imagine applying that principle to any other area of negligence, whether it be the negligent factory owner who allows his machine to cut off the hand of a worker, or even, let's take it simply, a driving case. Would it be enough to ride the defendant out that somebody was prepared to stand up and say, "Well, I'm a driver or I'm a factory owner and I think that was perfectly all right"? The application of Bolam in its strictest sense, therefore, effectively disqualified a judge from performing the proper judicial function, which is, as we all know, to listen to the evidence, to decide which side of a disputed case the evidence he prefers, and to give judgment accordingly.
In your position, acting for plaintiffs then, claimants now, this was a cast-iron defence, wasn't it?
Yes, in its strict form, it literally was a cast-iron defence. And in the early years with my practice in medical law, not only were, I felt often, very spurious respectable bodies of medical opinion trotted out on behalf of defendants, but sometimes they were old dinosaurs who'd been following out-of-date practice for years and were prepared to sanction it. And in those cases, judges who felt utterly bound by Bolam would say, "Well, I can't find negligence." And great injustice often resulted.
Can you give us any examples of such cases?
Well, there's one particular case that scarred on my soul. And I was a youngish barrister then. It was 30 years ago and more. And it was a case tried by Mr. Justice Michael Wright in, I think, Cardiff. Just to take it very simply, in its shocking reality, a cesarean section was being performed. The surgeon had lifted the baby's body out, holding it by its feet, which is commonplace. And just before he pulled the head out of the incised uterus, it went into a very sharp spasm, a phenomenon which is very rare but is known to obstetric science. Thus, the head was trapped by a strongly spasming uterus within the womb while the body was out. It doesn't need me to say that the baby was therefore asphyxiating and in grave danger of brain damage and death. The claimant's plaintiff's experts, who were both very distinguished obstetricians, said there is an immediate and very simple way to release this trapped baby's head. You perform a vertical incision at right angles to the original uterine transverse incision, thus making a T-shaped aperture. That immediately cuts through the spasming muscle, immediately releases the baby's head, and you lift it out. That, they said, ought to have been done. Sadly, it wasn't. Instead, the obstetrician simply stood there, holding the baby's feet, with the head trapped within the spasming womb, and waited, and waited, and waited. What he knew, correctly, was that it would eventually release. The spasm would decline. But he waited and waited and waited, and when it did eventually decline, he lifted the baby out, by which time it was extremely severely brain damaged, and the family lived with a child that never slept, a child that needed 24-hour care, a child that when it made any noise at all was screaming. The family life was devastated and the child's life had no quality at all. Two professors from Guy's Hospital, professors of obstetrics, stepped up for the defence. They said that to cut the T incision at right angles to the first was completely unacceptable, and they cited a textbook called MacGillivray, a very old textbook of obstetrics, which called that T-shaped incision an unacceptable mutilation of the uterus, saying that it threatened the mother's future fertility. I vainly attempted to argue what most right-thinking people would agree with, namely that a living baby, totally viable, 9 months in the womb, perfectly normal, healthy, happy baby, was far more important than mutilating the uterus, far more important than any possible risk to her future fertility. But the two professors carried the day. The judge felt that Bolam was well and truly in play, and in its strict application, he ruled that there was no negligence for him to find. That case may seem to you shocking today. It was very shocking to me then. And I should, of course, have appealed it. I was young. Bolam was in its pomp. The two professors were very distinguished men from Guy's. And I didn't appeal it, partly, I have to say, because the family had enough of the law by that time. Had I done so, I'm quite sure that there would have been inevitably a judgment from the highest court in the land, greatly tempering the effect of Bolam.
So that was quite clearly a very profoundly worrying example of the effect of Bolam. After that, did the whole notion of doctor knows best began to be eroded somewhat?
As the years went on, the old concept that a doctor is God almost and that whatever doctor says goes began to be eroded. Greater public education, wider dissemination of medical information in the media, and the general sense that we all have individual rights which matter led, I think, to a gradual weakening of that very strict dominance of Bolam. Good judges, it seems to me, and I can tell from experience, were dismissing what appeared to be cast-iron Bolam defences on the grounds they didn't find them at all persuasive or logical or acceptable. And it must be so, for otherwise no truly defended medical negligence action would ever have been won. So gradually, the good judges were seeing that the sort of application I've described in that uterine spasm case was really not an acceptable way for the courts to judge these cases. By the time Sidibe came along, which was 87, I think, it was clear from the intellectual gymnastics performed by the different law lords in that case that misgivings about Bolam in its strict sense had set in quite a big way. There are those who thought that Sidibe, which decided that the Bolam defence applied as much to the adequacy of disclosure of information for the consent of the patient, as it did to diagnosis and treatment, there were those who argued that it was a unanimous decision of the House of Lords, but a close reading of the judgments of the judges shows that they all approached it in rather a different way, except for dear Lord Diplock. In short, in that case, Diplock, who gave the leading judgment, said that when it comes to how much or how little the doctor has told you about the treatment proposed, that's to say about its risks, its benefits, the uncertainties or otherwise of outcome, the quantity of disclosure was entirely a matter for doctors themselves to decide. And that even if the defending sanction came from a very small minority, swimming against the mainstream tide of all other doctors, nevertheless, if there was such a body of opinion that sanctioned, for example, telling the patient in a given case almost nothing before the operation was conducted, if there was such a body, then, said Diplock, it was a complete defence, because Bolam applied as much to that as it did to issues of diagnosis and treatment. What was wrong with that, as I had the chance eventually to argue, as it turned out successfully in the case of Montgomery, was that whereas decisions about diagnosis and treatment are entirely based, obviously, on the doctor's special expertise, learning and experience, the decision about whether or not to consent to proposed treatment is entirely the patient's own decision.
Could you just remind us what the facts of Montgomery involved?
Yes. Well, Montgomery presented to me, after years of inveighing against Bolam in its strict form, the perfect storm of facts to deal with the idea that the Bolam defence should apply against allegations of inadequate disclosure of information. Mrs. Montgomery was pregnant with her first child. She was a 5'1" tall, a small lady, a long-standing insulin-dependent diabetic. The problem with such mothers is their babies tend to grow abnormally large. It's called macrosomia. And a feature of these abnormally large babies in insulin-dependent mothers is they grow very large fatty deposits on their shoulders. This puts them at grave risk, up to 10%, 9 or 10%, of what's called shoulder dystocia if vaginal delivery is attempted. And that means that the head comes out, but the shoulder becomes stuck behind the symphysis pubis, behind the mother's anatomy. And it's sometimes extremely difficult to extricate the baby from that situation. The mother was very frightened. She was very small. She knew her baby was getting bigger and bigger. They, amazingly, ultrasound scanned for size every fortnight, which is extremely unusual, because they knew it was getting bigger and bigger. The female obstetrician admitted she didn't do the last of these scans for size before delivery because she knew it would only frighten the mother. She knew it was getting bigger and bigger. The mother asked whether she would be able to get this baby out normally, and the obstetrician gave no information about the risks, which were very real, up to 10% of shoulder dystocia. She told her nothing about the fact that within the 10% who suffer shoulder dystocia, 1 to 2% will end up gravely damaged or dead. She told the mother that if anything went wrong in labour, they would do a cesarean section, without informing her that by the time shoulder dystocia has occurred, if it does, the head's out, the shoulder's stuck, it's too late to do a cesarean section. So in effect, she gave the mother no information at all. When the labour was induced, I should tell you it was induced, it wasn't the mother's choice at all. It became obstructed. Instead of doing a cesarean at that point, when the baby was stuck halfway down, they pumped her full of syntocinon, thus augmenting the uterine contractions and forced the baby down the birth canal. Out the baby came, the head was out, the shoulder became stuck, and at that point, too late to do a section, panic, all the manoeuvres failed. The doctor then tried to saw through the mother's symphysis pubis, which is a third world practice where they can't do theatre surgery for section. And she didn't have the right kit and only got halfway through the symphysis pubis and gave up. Finally, as she put it in her own evidence, with some superhuman effort, she pulled the baby out, by which time she avulsed the brachial plexus in the process, which means he had a flail and useless arm, and he was oxygen-deprived and brain-damaged.
So now, with Montgomery, Rupert Jackson said in one of his public lectures that the invaders have captured the very citadel, the citadel of doctor immunity. This case marked a particularly significant development in that patients are now regarded as persons holding rights rather than as passive recipients of the care of medical profession. Consumers exercising choices. Do you think there's any further the Montgomery trend can go?
Yes, I do. I've been accused of suggesting that the opinion of defending doctors is irrelevant in these cases. And of course, I say absolutely nothing of the kind. Clearly, in any allegation of medical negligence, the opinion of defending expert doctors will be first of all, obviously relevant. Secondly, frequently persuasive to judges listening carefully to both sides. And finally, I have to say, quite often probably decisive. Because if a really convincing and honourable defence is put forward that what was done or not done was acceptable in the scale of, or I should say, in the spectrum of different approaches in medicine, then clearly judges must be strongly affected by such opinions. So I mustn't be taken as saying that Bolam must be, the central idea of Bolam, it should be removed altogether. What I do say is that anything approaching Bolam principle should no longer disqualify a judge from performing his proper judicial function. I think that there has been more than one breach in the wall of Bolam proper. Obviously, Montgomery has gone a long way to saying that doctors should not in all cases be in a position to set their own standards, that the courts and the judges must have their say. I've had a couple or three other cases in which small breaches were made in the wall. For example, in the case of Birch and UCLH, in which a diabetic woman had a problem with her vision of a kind she'd had before and is often caused by vascular compromise due to diabetes. The first doctor, the physician who wanted to examine her, in case there was something sinister causing the vision difficulty, which is usually temporary and goes away if you wait and watch and see, he wanted her to have an MRI angiogram to check the blood vessels and the interior of the head and the brain, which is non-invasive, carries no real risks, but would have given a very good picture of whether there was something nasty or not. She was sent, because the MRI wasn't working at Watford General at the weekend, to the National Hospital in Queen Square, where she fell unintentionally among the surgeons, who, because of the selection bias of people who end up in the Queen Square Hospital, expected they would have to operate on this lady, because normally people who arrive there have been through three or four diagnostic stages and have probably got something very nasty in their heads. And they prefer the catheter angiogram, whereby you push a catheter up into the groin, up towards the heart and the head, and then pump dye in. Now, that gives, they say, a slightly better picture for them as surgeons, but of course surgery was the most unlikely prospect in this particular case. But it carries a risk, and it thought that with diabetic women, probably a greater risk of stroke than with the rest of us. So they went straight ahead, banged in the catheter angiogram. She had a stroke, lost quite a lot of her function and her vision in her middle age. And they said, perfectly normal Bolam defence. We're surgeons. We think that's the right way to do it. We think we were absolutely justified. We might have had to operate on this lady's brain or head. And it was perfectly reasonable. And the judge said in answer to our arguments, well, the surgeons have got a point, but there was an alternative, the one originally offered by the physician, which was the non-invasive MRI scan, which would have given a good enough picture for them, given particularly that she was unlikely indeed to have anything other than minor compromise due to diabetes to her blood vessels. And the judge said, I'm not impressed by the Bolam defence here. She should have been told of the alternative, and given the option of the alternative, and given her intelligence and her history, she would have chosen the alternative, non-invasive, and she wouldn't have had a stroke. There's one example where Bolam was sidelined in a way that you can probably see made a lot of sense. Another way in which Bolam has been sidelined is in the cases which I had the chance to do. One was called Penny, Palmer and Cannon, which went to the Court of Appeal with Lord Wolfe sitting, and the other was called Lillywhite against UCH, in which Buxton, Latham and Arden were the Court of Appeal. I won't go into too much detail, but in both those cases, the defence in Penny, Palmer and Cannon was what was on the cervical smear slides was very difficult to interpret, and it was perfectly reasonable to miss the fact that these women in fact had cancerous cells. And the claimant's experts said, rubbish. Either they were visible as abnormalities, or at the very least, on that slide was ambiguity, which should have been passed up higher for further and specialist examination. So the perfectly strong Bolam defence. Look, what was seen there, we say as doctors, was reasonable to decide no cancer. Although we as great specialists would have said it was cancer, but not the smear testers. And in Lillywhite, the issue was whether big experts should have seen the absence of certain features of a fetal brain by obstetric ultrasound. The lowly ultrasonographer had herself said they're missing and passed it up to the experts, who had both said, no, they're not missing. Well, they were missing. And the defence was basically, well, we experts thought they were there. And if we thought they were there, that's a reasonable enough Bolam defence. No, said the judge in that case, as had Lord Wolfe in the Penny, Palmer and Cannon case. There are aspects here which are for the judge to decide. Namely, what was actually there to be seen? We will decide that as judges. And once we decide what was there to be seen, then the issue is, should it have been picked up by the people who missed it? So there, the judges were taking back some of the issue and saying, some of this is actually fact. They can't both be right about what was there or what was not there. So in that circumstance, it's not so much opinion as a factual decision for a judge. So they were two also smallish inroads on Bolam. So it's eroded. It's gone in the adequacy of disclosure for consent. Montgomery says now, the issue is not whether an idiosyncratic minority of doctors think it was all right to tell the patient almost nothing. The issue is, what would a reasonable patient in this patient's position have wanted and needed to know? That is, the material information must be disclosed. And that is not for the doctors to decide, because, after all, there are almost as many opinions about that as there are doctors. And I have still met some who say, oh, I don't think we should tell them anything. And so they took it completely away from the doctors in Montgomery. And gradually, I think, Bolam will be consigned to history on the basis that nothing should disqualify a judge in our courts from making a finding on the evidence that he prefers. And that doesn't mean that the doctor's evidence is unimportant. It's of great importance and always will be, but it won't be necessarily decisive.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.